Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Challenge of Entel by Jan Roland, narrated by Mary Sarah. Prologue, August 1804. Never had Mr. Bennet of Longbourn in Hertfordshire thought his life would go so wrong. The scion of a long line of gentlemen, respectable, though not prominent, he had always intended to marry a good woman. A woman who would provide him an heir, companionship throughout the days of his life, and contentment, if not happiness. But now, after almost 17 years of marriage, he found it difficult to abide his wife, and the situation was wearing on him. Marrying Maggie Gardner had been a mistake. Bennet was forced to own to himself, if to no one else. After a short acquaintance, in which her sunny character and warm openness had recommended her to Bennet as a desirable marriage partner, he had proposed to her immersed in the throes of infatuation. It was only after they were married, when he had learned the truth of his companion in life. She was a silly woman, one with a paucity of intelligence and interests which did not at all align with his own. Still, Bennet was a philosophical man, and had looked at the situation with the self-deprecating humour for which he was known. She may not be Aristotle, but Maggie was possessed of a sunny disposition and her share of beauty, and as he was joined with her, Bennet thought to make the best of the situation. As patiently as he was able, Bennet began to teach her, to instruct her in the ways of proper behaviour, and, at least in part, to open her mind to the world. For many years, it seemed to have worked. As Maggie had improved, Bennet had found her companionship to become more pleasant and engaging. While he could not say that his infatuation for her had deepened into an abiding devotion, he was at least happy with her. And equally important, Bennet thought Maggie was happy too. Was this not what any man wished for the woman he had taken into his care? But then things had changed, so slowly that Bennet had not even realised it until it had become impossible to ignore. The woman Bennet had married had given way to a creature even sillier, one who was ruled by her imagined nerves, one fretful and frightened. It could all be traced back to the unfortunate fact of the entail on Longbourn, and, even more unfortunately, the Bennet's lack of a son. Maggie had loved Jane from the moment she was born, and who could not? Jane had always been a beautiful child, quiet, calm, patient, and happy. Doting on the girl was something that had come easy to his wife, and Bennet was no less pleased with his eldest daughter. When she had been with child a second time, Maggie had convinced herself the child would be a son, only to be disappointed with the emergence of another daughter. And Lizzie's character, so different from Jane's, which delighted in knowledge, her open ways more similar to Maggie's than she wished to confess, made her more difficult for Maggie to understand and guide. Then, with each subsequent girl born to them, Maggie's nerves had become more prevalent, the unattractive parts of her character more obvious. When Lydia, their youngest, was born, his wife had taken to her bed, wailing against the injustice of it all. Then, when no other children were to come to them, her behaviour had worsened. Her thoughts consumed with her certainty, their unknown cousin, his heir, would throw her from the house as soon as Bennet was cold in his grave, never mind the fact that Bennet was only a few years older than his wife. These past years had been difficult. Gone was the sunny and happy woman he married, replaced with a nervous creature whose company Bennet found difficult to tolerate. Bennet had had no illusions about his own character. He was not an industrious man, preferring the comforts of his library to work done on the estate, with the possibility of an air scorched, leaving nothing more than dim embers. Seeing to an estate from which his children would not profit became less appealing. It was short-sighted, he knew, but there it was. Maggie, convinced her salvation lay in marrying her daughters off to whomever would have them, began to spend more of their income, determined they should present themselves to greater advantage, though not one of them was yet out, and Bennet found he had not the firmness of purpose to curb her. It all seemed like so much work, akin to struggling against the tide. Though he had managed to put some money away for his family's eventual support, his determination became a casualty in the face of his wife's ever more strident worries. Bennet even found himself beginning to treat the woman with disdain and ridicule. This was a disgusting way for a gentleman, one charged with the care of his family, to behave. But though he attempted to curb it, Bennet often responded without thinking. Soon he wondered if it might have become a habit. Not long after Jane turned 15 years of age, prompting Maggie's insistence she debut in society, Bennet received a note from his brother, Mr. Phillips. Phillips was married to Maggie's sister, a woman sillier than even Bennet's own wife. But while he was a stuffy man, fonder of port wine than Bennet's own prodigious taste for it, he was a good man, who served as the town solicitor. He had also been absent from Meryton for the past week, attending some gathering or another. Phillips served as Bennet's own attorney in most matters, so his summons was not unusual. The man's demeanour when Bennet joined him in his office was, however.
"My apologies, Bennet,"
said Mr. Phillips when Bennet entered the room, gesturing to a cane propped against the side of his desk. Phillips continued.
"I would have attended you at Longbourn, but I turned my ankle my last day in London, and have had a difficult time getting around." "It is no trouble, brother," replied Bennet. "You said you had an urgent need to see me?" "Not so urgent as it seems," said Phillips. "But I have discovered something extraordinary, which will be of great interest to you."
Phillips leaned forward in his chair.
"I believe I have stumbled upon a solution to your problem."
Bennet frowned, uncertain to what Phillips referred.
"I do not believe I have informed you of any problems of late." "The entail,"
clarified Phillips.
"What of it?" "It is not so ironclad as I might have thought. In fact, I have learned that a simple entailment is rarely used any longer. Or at least not by itself."
A rush of hope surged in Bennet's breast.
"Then by all means, let me know what you have learned. Are you telling me I have the means to do away with the entail in favour of my own children?"
Phillips nodded once, his mien betraying his excitement.
"You can end it and leave Longbourn to whichever of your daughters you wish. And the process is not at all onerous. You see, I happened to mention your situation to a colleague of mine I have not seen nor heard from in many years."
Sitting back in his chair, Philip's look became one of introspection.
"It was not that I expected to learn anything new, you understand. I do not even recall the genesis of our conversation, to own the truth. But when I mentioned the entail on your estate, and your fears for the future of your family, he asked why I did not bar the entail and end it. I was shocked, of course. To the best of my knowledge, entails were near impossible to break in a legal sense. It appears they still are in Scotland. But in England, a process referred to as common recovery has been in place for many years. which allows a man to bar the heir from ever receiving the estate. And this common recovery is available for our use? Asked Bennet. It is available for anyone who possesses an entailed estate, confirmed Phillips. My colleague informed me he had not seen an entail used in some time, though they might still be preferred in some small neighbourhoods, which may, I suppose, be called backwards.
Phillips paused and chuckled.
As you know, I spend less of my time in London than even you do. I have practiced the law for many years, and those matters in which I have experience, I understand well. But Longbourn is the only estate hereabouts which has an entail, and I have never had to contend with it on any other property. It is clear your ancestor who instituted it had no knowledge of the matter either, else he would have used the newer method of ensuring the solvency of the estate. Strict settlement. So, to be clear, said Bennet,
steering the conversation back to the matter at hand,
you can file for this common recovery. Then what happens? Then the estate is yours to do as you wish.
Phillips leaned forward.
Your legal will would then take precedence, allowing you to leave the estate to any of your daughters, or even divide it up between them.
Bennet frowned.
That is one reason for an entail in the first place, to prevent an estate from being broken up, along with protecting it from profligate heirs. It is true, said Phillips. Then you can leave it to Jane, or to Lizzie.
Phillips smiled.
Your second daughter might be the best inheritor, given her quickness.
Gripped in his thoughts as he was, Bennet nodded without thinking.
Perhaps, though she is still full young, Maggie might object, for Jane is the eldest. Jane might feel passed over, should I leave it to Lizzie. Furthermore, it is the girl's future husband who would own the estate, and must be my concern.
Phillips shrugged.
Then when your daughter marries, you utilize a strict settlement agreement with him. That way, the estate cannot be broken up or sold for the next generation. Thus, you would have protected it as much as you are able. Either way, with one of your daughters as your heir, you protect your wife and any remaining daughters, as you can write any conditions you wish into the contract. And if the man who marries your heir does not agree, you can disinherit her in favour of one of her sisters. Then it is settled, said Bennet.
He laughed as a sudden thought came into his head.
My cousin may well suffer apoplexy when he hears of this, if he does not beat down my door in his rage. Given what you have told me of the man,
replied Phillips,
saving the estate from him is as much of a relief as providing for your family. That is true,
said Mr. Bennet, shaking his head in disgust.
Collins is a brute of a man, one I hope I never have the misfortune to meet again. Good riddance, then, said Phillips. I shall draw up the papers and bring them around to Longbourn when they are complete.
Phillips paused and grimaced.
Or I shall, if this ankle will allow it. If you are the means of my family's salvation,
replied Bennet,
I shall ride to Cumbria to retrieve the papers. Let me know when they are complete, and I shall return. Excellent.
Bennet shook his brother's hand, thanking him once again, and then rose to depart. During the ride back to Longbourn, Bennet considered the changes about to take place in his life. If he was to leave Longbourn to Jane, for Bennet was uncomfortable with passing her over, she would be provided for. Given what Phillips had told him, Bennet knew his other daughters would be similarly cared for. But perhaps with the change in their fortunes, he might convince Maggie to put some extra money aside for their other daughters. Dowries to make them more marriageable, or provide for their support, if they were not inclined to marry. If Longbourn was to benefit his family, perhaps Bennett himself would take more interest in it. The feeling of being in control of his destiny was intoxicating. Bennett felt freer than he had in years. The return to Longbourn was accomplished quickly. It was doubtful Maggie had even known of his absence, so ensconced had he been in his library of late. As he entered the house, Bennett could hear her raised voice, and he grimaced because of it. As he was still uncertain about Philip's information and wary of exciting Maggie's hopes, only to dash them later, he would say nothing for now. Once it was an established fact, Maggie would be the first to know.
Papa?
A girlish voice interrupted his thoughts, and Bennett, who was handing his hat and gloves to Mr. Hill, noted the approach of his most intelligent daughter.
Where did you go?
Just to Meryton, to visit your uncle, said Bennett,
smiling at Elizabeth with pleasure.
I hope nothing has happened in my absence to upset your mother.
A smile crept over his face as Elizabeth looked skyward.
Lydia was running in the sitting room after Kitty and tore Jane's new gown.
Bennett shook his head, another thought working its way through his consciousness. Kitty and Lydia, though only 10 and 8 years of age respectively, were already showing high spirits, which bordered on impropriety. Should the matter of the entail be overcome, perhaps it would be best to ensure the girls were taught decorum. It would be best if they were instructed whether Longbourn was his to do with as he pleased or not.
No suitors have beat down my door for your sister's hand?
I am certain Jane does not wish for a suitor, said Elizabeth, frowning at his jest.
Nor should she,
said Bennett, forcing his humour away in favour of earnestness.
Do not fear, Lizzie. I shall speak with your mother. This business of pushing Jane into society when she is not ready must cease.
Though he surprised the girl by the firmness of his tone, it was clear from her approving smile she agreed. And Bennett realized he had become far too distant from his family. If this simple statement was a surprise to his closest daughter, Maggie was not the only one who needed to alter her behavior.
Do not concern yourself, Lizzie,
said Bennett.
There will be changes made at Longbourn, for I have just learned a most surprising thing from your uncle.
Bennett held up his hand with a laugh at Elizabeth's blatant curiosity.
Please, allow me my secrets for now, my love. You shall learn of them before long.
Very well, Papa, said Elizabeth,
and she turned and departed for the sitting room. The open door allowed the sound of his wife berating her youngest to reach his ears more clearly, and he shook his head. The return of the Maggie he had married would be a boon indeed. The changes he was contemplating would benefit them all. Hopefully, Philip's information was correct, for it may become the salvation of his family.
Chapter 1 October, 1811.
Laughter punctuated a typical meal at Longbourn, home of the Bennett family near Meryton, in Hertfordshire. Coupled with conversation, a healthy measure of teasing, and a smattering of gossip common to families of the area. But while the reader might be excused for assuming the family was one improper and difficult to tolerate, nothing could be further from the truth. For while their spirits were high, they were not improper, and though laughter and teasing prevailed, affection prevailed among them all. The passage of 7 years had done them all much good, their worries for the future now far in the past. The presence of Mrs. Garrett at the table ensured good behaviour, particularly of the youngest members of the party. She was a widow, stern but fair, knowledgeable yet compassionate. Mr. Bennett had retained her after he had put the entail aside, and for a time she had served as both companion for the elder girls and governess for the younger. Now she was companion to all, but her focus was on Kitty and Lydia,
the only two not yet out in society. The sound of laughter rang out over the table, and Elizabeth, the second eldest of the Bennet girls, noted that a sharp look from the elder woman moderated Lydia's response to whatever jest her mother had made. By her side, Mary was listening to something her father was saying, interest unfeigned. Jane, as was her wont, was quiet, while Mrs. Bennet was speaking with Kitty and Lydia, her voice, as always, voluble. It was a balm to Elizabeth's soul to see such a sight as her family in harmony, all behaving as the gentlefolk they were. Even as a young girl of 13 summers, Elizabeth had recognized the alarming behavior of her mother, and had seen the way her younger sisters were beginning to emulate it. Many times she had sat at that table, listening to her mother lament some ill, real or imagined, and wondered what would become of them all. Now she pondered what might have happened to her family had their course remained unchecked. But checked it had been, and whether one considered the circumstance which had led to the change to be blind luck or the natural order of the world, the entire family had benefited from it. Elizabeth could not be more grateful. At 13, she thought her future fraught with uncertainty. Now, at 20, she knew she would be cared for, would always have a home, regardless of what happened. She even had a small dowry to allow her some modicum of freedom in the future. This was not a universal opinion. Elizabeth turned and looked at her father, noting the affectionate way he was sporting with Jane over some matter or another. From a few comments he had made over the years, it seemed his former heir's condemnation had been swift and unrelenting. Mr. Collins, the cousin, had passed some 2 or 3 years after the entail had ended, and from what she understood, he had not been a good man. His loss unlamented. The son was as implacable in his own denunciation. Though her father had told her several times, his words on the subject were much more plentiful. The language almost absurd. As Elizabeth did not expect to ever make Mr. Collins's acquaintance, given his offence over being passed over, his opinions did not concern her overmuch. But the comical way in which her father portrayed his cousin's reproachful letters was a source of amusement for them all. Mrs. Bennet, to whom the Collinses had been evil incarnate, tolerated mentions of her former tormentor with an indulgent exasperation. That night, however, the conversation concerned another matter altogether.
"I wonder what you will all do now," commented Mr. Bennet, as he carved the roast beef, which was their supper. "When our new neighbours did not appear at the last assembly, I thought the young ladies of the neighbourhood might expire of disappointment."
It was a mark of the changed relationship between husband and wife that the comment was not meant to provoke his wife, nor was the response offered in a flurry of nerves. In fact, Mrs. Bennet sat calmly, regarding her husband with a slight smile.
"I dare say we shall all survive our neighbours' absence, until they see fit to grace us with their presence."
"But is it not strange?" asked Mary. "Mr. Bingley came to Netherfield, professed to our uncle how much he liked the place, signed the lease, and then disappeared again, greeting no one in the neighbourhood."
"It seems a matter of urgent business arose, which necessitated his absence," said Mr. Bennet, handing the tray of now-cut beef to his eldest daughter. "Or so your uncle informed me."
"Then he will come when he will come, Papa," said Elizabeth. "Though we might all relish the opportunity to make new acquaintances, Mr. Bingley must see to his own affairs."
"That is wise of you, Lizzie," said Mr. Bennet with a smile.
Then he directed a sly look which seemed to encompass both Elizabeth and Jane.
"I might have thought you both would repine their loss as much as Miss Goulding or the Long Sisters do. Mr. Bingley was said to have a friend who intended to visit also. Had they come, you might already be caught in the throes of infatuation.
While Jane protested any such notion, Elizabeth only smiled at her father. For my part, I shall not pine after the attentions of a gentleman with whom I'm not acquainted. Then you are more sensible than Chloe Goulding, said Mary with a sniff of disdain. At the assembly, I heard her boasting of how she would have caught Mr. Bingley if he had only attended. Chloe Goulding has a high opinion of herself, said Mrs. Bennet. Everyone knows Jane is the most beautiful girl in the neighbourhood. Had anyone caught Mr. Bingley, it would have been Jane. The words proved that Mrs. Bennet was not quite reformed, but knowing her mother's character, her words did not surprise Elizabeth. Rather than pushing her girls forward at every opportunity, Mrs. Bennet had learned to become more circumspect, to take their opinions into consideration. But she was a fierce defender against any slights, and a critical observer might claim she was less proper than might be expected of the wife of a gentleman. Elizabeth loved her mother, but she did not lack understanding of her. Many of the things that interested Elizabeth were a mystery to Mrs. Bennet, but she was a good wife and mother. Kept house with as much flair as anyone in the neighbourhood, and no one could complain about the table she set.
If Jane should be inclined toward the gentleman, I would have no objections.
Mr. Bennet smiled at his eldest, who had coloured in embarrassment.
But let us leave that sort of conversation until after we have made the gentleman's acquaintance, as our Lizzie says. Besides, said Mr. Bennet, with a sly look that suggested a coming tease, it seems to me my daughters will be well occupied regardless. For I have heard there will be a company of militia quartered in Meryton for the winter.
There was a variety of reactions around the table to Mr. Bennet's news. While Jane looked on with interest, the same as Elizabeth herself, Mary was indifferent, her huff speaking volumes, if the rolling of her eyes did not. Mrs. Bennet appeared somewhat interested, understandable given her occasional stories of the regiment of militia who had stayed in the area when she had been a girl. The most demonstrative reactions were reserved, yet again, for the youngest members of their company.
It is unfair, exclaimed Lydia,
though she did not do so in a screech which had characterized her outbursts years before.
The militia is rarely quartered nearby. But as we are not out, Kitty and I will have little to do with them. Even Maria Lucas shall have more fun with the militia than we.
I do not care to socialize with officers, ventured Kitty in that tentative voice she always used when contradicting her younger sister. It should be much too dull, I would think.
Lydia directed a glare at her sister, though it had little effect, as Mrs. Bennet spoke up.
And it is well you are not yet out, Lydia, if this is how you would behave.
With a harumph, Lydia sat back, annoyed with her mother for not taking her part. Mrs. Bennet noticed and looked down the table at her husband, who joined her in indulging in a shaken head at their youngest daughter's attitude.
Militia officers are not some mythical standard of masculine perfection, Lydia,
said Mr. Bennet.
I suspect you would agree they are nothing special, should you meet them. And you will have occasion to meet the officers in the appropriate settings. But you must remember,
Mr. Bennet's tone became firm,
to adhere to decorum. For should you not, I will deny you their company the next time the opportunity arises.
The pout with which Lydia regarded her father almost set him to laughing. As it was, he maintained his firm demeanour, prompting Lydia to sigh and give up her objections.
It is hard being the youngest, Lydia, said Mrs. Bennet, grasping her daughter's hand and giving it a consoling squeeze. But you must remember, all your sisters endured the same restrictions when they were your age, and they all passed through the experience, I hope.
little wiser. The three eldest Bennet daughters chorused their agreement.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?